Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Okay, today we will be studying the Vimamsaka Sutta. This is the sutta which deals with how to make a proper investigation of the Buddha to decide whether he is qualified as a proper spiritual teacher. And we could use some of the principles taught in this sutta as a standard for judging the qualifications of contemporary Buddhist teachers, though we shouldn't apply to them quite the same standards that the Buddha himself would fulfill. Okay, this is sutta number 47 in the Majjhima Nikaya on page 415 in the translation. Okay, the sutta begins when the Buddha says that a monk who is an inquirer, or actually the Pali word vimamsaka, we say investigator, somebody who doesn't accept things just through devotion and faith, but who likes to investigate, to inquire, and to ascertain matters for himself. Then he says, he has the phrase, not knowing how to gauge another's mind. The expression here means that it's referring to a monk who doesn't have the higher knowledge or direct knowledge called paricitta pariyaya jnana, the knowledge which is able to directly read another person's mind or see into another person's mind. This is one of the higher knowledges that can develop as a result of mastery in the sphere of samadhi, or very deep concentration. Some meditators who develop the four jhanas, or meditative absorptions, can then use that powerful, concentrated, focused mind as an instrument for directly seeing into the mental processes of other persons. And if a monk has that ability, he could use it to look into the mind of the Buddha. He probably wouldn't be able to fully understand the full breadth and depth of the Buddha's mind, but when he investigates, he would see at least that the Buddha's mind is completely purified of all defilements. But in this sutta, the Buddha is going to show how one who doesn't have that very special ability can make a proper investigation of the Buddha in order to determine whether he is trustworthy, reliable as a spiritual master. And so the Buddha first introduces the topic, then the monks say that they will be want to hear the explanation from the Buddha, and that they will remember it after they hear it. Okay, so now we come to the central part of the sutta, starting with paragraph 4. And now you see the Buddha appeals to certain valid criteria of knowledge. In later Indian philosophy, these come to be termed pramanas. That is, pramana is, you say, a criterion of knowledge. And different schools of Indian philosophy accepted different criteria of knowledge. For example, for the Brahmins, the supreme criterion of knowledge were the Vedas. Whatever was written in the Vedas was taken to be what we would call gospel truth, absolute, infallible, infallible, unmistakable truth. Of course, each school of Vedic philosophy interpreted the Vedas in such different ways that they seem to have almost nothing in common except the view that the Vedas are an infallible source of knowledge. But the Buddha and some of the other religious thinkers of his period were characterized by their refusal to recognize the Vedas or any revealed or written scriptures. The scriptures in those days weren't written. Any type of sacred scriptures, they refused to recognize them as authoritative. And for the Buddha, there are basically two criteria for knowledge. One is direct experience, which can be either direct sensory experience or else you might call yogic intuition. That is the exercise of these higher spiritual faculties which unfold through the mastery of concentration as a means to directly perceive realities for oneself. Whether it's yogic intuition or sensory experience, they have in common the fact that they are direct, immediate types of experience. So what you see, hear, smell, taste, and so on, can be taken to be, to some extent, a valid basis of knowledge. Of course, there are also erroneous perceptions, deceptive, distorted perceptions. So one can't place in complete, unquestionable trust in perception, but at least it is a starting point, a fairly reliable starting point in constructing the edifice, the tower of knowledge. And the other source of knowledge, the other pramana or criterion recognized by the Buddha is reason or inference, what can be deduced from other things that are known for certainty. And so here in this first passage, the Buddha is going to show the procedure which begins with something that can be directly seen, in other words, with direct experience, and then uses this as a basis for drawing inferences about what cannot be seen. We use this procedure, well, the standard classical Indian example is when you see a passing a house, maybe your own house, and if you see smoke coming out of the windows, then you draw the inference that there's a fire in the house. Of course, the inference could be wrong. It's not infallible. It could be just some relative is visiting and he's a big cigar smoker and the breeze just happens to be blowing his cigar smoke out the window. But if you see billows of smoke rising coming out the window, then you might draw the inference that it's something has caught fire in the house. Okay, so in this case, one is trying to check the qualities of the Buddha by using what is available to direct perception. And what is available to direct perception that might reveal the qualities of somebody's mind? One doesn't try to determine the qualities of a mind by smelling them, by cutting off a slice of their flesh and tasting it. And one can't really determine that by touching them, but by sight, one could see certain modes of behavior which enable one to draw inferences regarding the person's states of mind. And then there are things that one hears, namely the speech of that person, the words that he or she might speak, or else the statements that others might make about that person. Though these, of course, have to be treated with a great deal of reserve. But what's most important is what one can see and hear for oneself. And so the Buddha says, a bhikkhu who is an inquirer, not knowing how to gauge another's mind, should investigate the Tathagata with respect to two kinds of states, states cognizable through the eye, that is, the visible behavior, and states cognizable through the ear, that is, the speech of the Buddha, his statements. Thinking, are there found in the Tathagata or not any defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? Okay, now defilements are really states of mind. But states of mind don't remain locked up within themselves. But states of mind motivate behavior. They express themselves in bodily action and in speech. And so from a person's behavior and his or her utterances, we can come to some conclusions about the character of that person. In fact, the way we form our assessments of people's characters is on the basis of their behavior and their speech. And behavior sometimes includes not only the gross actions, but even things like facial expressions. Sometimes the look in a person's eyes can reveal a great deal. And so what one is checking here is to see whether there are any actions, physical behavior, or statements of the Buddha that reveal or betray tendencies to the defiled qualities of mind. Basically, the three fundamental defilements, greed, hatred, delusion, or any of their offshoots or secondary defilements, like pride, arrogance, anger, laziness, hypocrisy, competitiveness, arrogance, and so forth. And so one looks for the physical behavior. Does he show any kind of tendencies of liking certain things that might indicate? Here one is not even concerned anymore to check on gross behavior. Though one can also check the gross behavior. Does he show any indifference to the well-being of others in his behavior? For example, even mindlessly swatting a mosquito that might land on his body. That would be an indication of some degree of aversion. Any kind of greed, signs of greed, like maybe showing preferences to certain people, having attachment to certain people. Maybe if he's offered food, different types of food, showing an inordinate degree of preference for one particular dish. A Buddha will be quite equanimous with regard to all different types of foods. Out of politeness to his hosts, if he's being offered a meal, he would select something from each dish, but you wouldn't see him going grasping for more of this or of that, but he just accepts equanimously whatever is offered. And there aren't any traces of delusion in his behavior, any kind of, you would say, actions that betray, say, even lack of mindfulness, thoughtlessness. In fact, there's a very beautiful passage that comes in another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, which I didn't include in the reading list because it's almost self-explanatory. But in this sutta, it's number 91, called the Brahmayu Sutta. There is an old Brahmin who is, I think he's 120 years old, and he hears a report that the Buddha has arisen in the world, and he wants to check out whether this report is true or not, but the Buddha is living quite far away from him. And so he sends his pupil, a young Brahmin student named Uttara, to investigate the Buddha. And the young Brahmin Uttara spends 7 months in the presence of the Buddha, observing all of his behavior in every way. Then after these 7 months have gone, he returns to his teacher and reports to him what he has seen of the Buddha. And we have this described on his report on pages 747 through 49. Or actually, it's not 746. Describes how he walks. He walks, for example, he always puts his right foot first. He does not extend his foot too far or put it down too near. If one does that, it shows some lack of mindfulness, attentiveness. He walks neither too quickly nor too slowly. He walks without his knees knocking together, without his ankles knocking together. And then going down a few lines, when he turns to look around, he does so with his whole body. He doesn't look around this way. But when he wants, they call this the elephant look, because an elephant, when it wants to see what's behind it, it turns its whole body. So this shows the complete self-possession, self-awareness of a Buddha. And when he's walking, he always looks just a plow yoke's length before him, even though beyond that he has unhindered knowledge and vision. And then when he goes indoors, he does not raise or lower his body or bend it forward or back. He turns round neither too far from the seat nor too near it. He does not lean on the seat with his hand. He does not throw his body into the seat as though thinking, wow, I'm really tired, I want to enjoy a little rest. But he sits down again mindfully, self-aware. And when he's sitting indoors, he does not fidget with his hands, like somebody who is idle, doing this, that. Nor does he play with his feet. He does not sit with his hand in his chin like this. Then when he's being offered a meal, first he always accepts, they always give the water first so that the monks can wash out their bowl. So when he's receiving the water, he does not raise or lower the bowl, tip it forwards or backwards. He receives neither too little nor too much water for the bowl. He tells his donor to stop pouring the water exactly at the right time. When he washes the bowl, he doesn't make a noise, splashing noise, but he does it slowly and mindfully. And similarly, when he receives the rice, he does not raise or lower the bowl, and he receives the rice exactly in the right proportion, neither too much nor too little. He makes up very even size. In India, they use the hands to prepare the food. So he rolls up just the proper size, call us the lump of food, ball of food. Then he just chews the food a few times and then swallows it. Then after the meal, then he receives the water for washing the bowl in the same way. And he washes it again without making a splashing sound. Then when he has eaten, he sits in silence for a while, but he does not let the time for the blessing go by. And then when he has eaten and he gives the blessing, he does not do so criticizing the meal or expecting, encouraging the people to give another meal, but he instructs the people, the supporters, with a talk on the Dhamma. Then when he departs, again he walks neither too fast nor too slow. Similarly, when he arrives in the monastery, he washes his feet. Of course, in India, they would walk barefoot, and so his feet would be exposed to the dust. But he does not concern himself with grooming his feet. I'm on paragraph 20 now. And having washed his feet, he seats himself cross-legged, sets his body erect, and establishes mindfulness in front of him. Then going down some lines, when he has gone to the monastery, he teaches the Dhamma to an audience. He neither flatters nor berates the audience, but again he just instructs them with a talk on the Dhamma. And his speech is distinct, intelligible, melodious, audible, ringing, euphonious, deep and sonorous. It goes as far as the audience, but doesn't issue beyond. In other words, he modulates his voice so that everybody could hear it, but he doesn't speak an excessively loud voice so that people in the distance can hear. And so these are some of the modes of behavior of the Buddha as observed by a Brahmin youth who has been trailing him. And so from these this type of behavior, one could tell from looking at the Buddha that there's no indications of the presence of any greed or hatred in him, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of unmindfulness or confusion. So there seems to be no states visible which reveal the presence of delusion. Those are things that one can infer from sight. Then, by hearing, one listens to the speech of the Buddha. And speech of the Buddha is described in another sutta, which is, I just thought of that one. It's the Prince of Baya Sutta. This is page 498. It's actually paragraph 8, that the speech that the Tathagata knows to be untrue or incorrect and unbeneficial and which is unwelcome and disagreeable to others, such speech the Tathagata does not utter. He doesn't say anything false. He doesn't say anything which is just pointless, just idle chatter. And he doesn't speak anything which is both false, unbeneficial, and disagreeable to others. But then the speech which the Tathagata knows to be true and correct, unbeneficial, or pointless, and disagreeable to others, that the Tathagata does not utter. But such speech as the Tathagata knows to be true, correct, and beneficial, but which is unwelcome and disagreeable to others, the Tathagata knows the time to use such speech. That is, his speech isn't always agreeable to others, since he has a large company of monks to train and to discipline, monks and nuns, and sometimes he has to speak to them quite sternly, strictly, if he sees that they're misbehaving. And also he will meet followers of other teachings and he will engage in some debate with them. And they won't be pleased with the Buddha maintaining his own line and not yielding to their point of view. But the Buddha will never speak anything which is false, anything which is pointless or unbeneficial to others. Okay, so now as the monk makes this examination, he comes to know that there are no defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear that are found in the Tathagata. He doesn't yet know that they don't exist, but through direct perception, he cannot see anything that reveals their presence. And so he draws the inference, at least the temporary inference, that they do not exist. But now he goes on to inquire, are there found in the Tathagata or not any mixed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? And when he investigates, he comes to know that no mixed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. And the mixed states are states that are, according to the commentary, states that show a combination of wholesome and unwholesome characteristics. But despite this explanation, I have to say, I can't see how a mixed state, if it has unwholesome features, why that shouldn't simply be included amongst the defiled states. So it seems this category, the sub-commentary has an interesting note. It says, this refers to the conduct of one who is engaged in purifying his conduct, but is unable to keep to it consistently. Sometimes his conduct is pure or bright, sometimes impure or dark. In other words, this could be taken to mean somebody who is earnest, sincere about following a spiritual training, but is not yet reached fulfillment and perfection in the training. And so in such a person, there can be a predominance of pure, undefiled behavior, but there will occasionally come signs of little indications of weakness, signs of vulnerability, which will show themselves through invisible and audible ways. Maybe generally the person is very restrained and very self-contained, but occasionally there might come a quick flash of annoyance might appear on the face. Or if he's given a certain dish, then the face will light up brightly because he likes this particular dish. And so by examining, he sees that the investigator sees that there is nothing discernible through the eye or through the ear which reveals even the slightest trace of very subtle defilements in the Tathagata. And then, coming to paragraph 6, he checks for pure or clean states cognizable through the eye or through the ear. And when he investigates, then he comes to know that cleansed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. We have quite a detailed account of the Buddha's behavior. Also in the beginning of the Brahmajala Sutta, the first sutta in the Digha Nikaya, in which two Brahmins are walking and one is the student, one the teacher, and the student is praising the Buddha, and the teacher is upset by the praise of his student. And then eventually this report comes to the Buddha, and then the Buddha says that those who praise, who have not really seen the Dhamma and praise the Buddha, generally do so on the basis of superficial things. Then he describes his own behavior, which the ordinary person might praise. For example, he always abstains from taking life, does not take what is not given, observes perfect celibacy, always speaks the truth, never speaks anything which is malicious or slanderous, and so on. Okay, so these investigations now establish that only pure states of bodily behavior, the Buddha's behavior of body and of speech, is always pure, And this implies that his mind is completely pure. But now the investigation has to go further. And the monk asks, has this venerable one, it's a little strange to me why suddenly the text uses the word venerable one instead of the Tathagata. Has this venerable one attained this wholesome state over a long time, or did he attain it only recently? And when he investigates, he comes to know that he has attained this wholesome state over a long time. He did not attain it only recently. And this is important as a criterion, because before one places complete trust in the spiritual teacher, one wants to make sure that his attainment is a stable one. If it's just somebody who has suddenly come into the limelight before, maybe a few weeks earlier, a few months earlier, he was unknown. Now suddenly he's been brought onto stage as a great enlightened spiritual teacher. One doesn't know what's going to happen in a few months, a few years. I remember back when I was living in California in the early 1970s, before I went to Asia to become a monk, there were so many, at that time, so many great gurus arriving from India, and like posters would appear on the walls that this guru is arriving, the divine master of the world. Everybody should come to see him at such and such an auditorium. If he touches you, you will get enlightened. If he smiles at you, you'll get enlightened. If this one embraces you, you'll get enlightened. And people were flocking to see this one, that one. And then a few months later, one reads that from the proceeds of these functions, of his tour in the United States, now he's given up his robes and he's settled down quite comfortably in a mansion someplace in the countryside of India. Now he has a beautiful American wife and he has three cars. And so the ones who skyrocket their way to fame are not always the ones who are reliable. But if one knows that this person has had this reputation as being a very pure, wise, holy person over a long time, of course one still can't place 100% trust in him, but at least one has a more secure basis for confidence than if he's just a recent star on the scene. Okay, now we come to number 8. Okay, now he makes the further investigation. Has this venerable one acquired renown and attained fame, so that the dangers connected with renown and fame are found in him? Then the Buddha adds an important sort of word of advice. For as long as a monk has not acquired renown and attained fame, then he doesn't face the dangers connected with renown and fame. But when he has acquired renown and attained fame, then he faces these dangers. And this is important, because what happens in many cases is that when some spiritual teacher becomes famous, well-known, very popular, this gives the opportunity for subtle defilements which had been previously dormant and hidden to start rising up, coming to the surface until they become very prominent. And other people might see them, but that person himself doesn't see them. And so it's easy for that person to get swept away by them, to become full of complacency, and then to lose sight of his spiritual practice, his attainments. For example, when somebody is admired by many disciples, he thinks, oh, I must be some outstanding, really gifted spiritual master. then he becomes proud of this, or he likes it, he starts liking the praise. When people praise him, then he feels very happy, uplifted. But if he hears some criticism, he's walking by, he hears, you know, that was a bore. His talks are starting to get a little boring, very repetitive. Then he thinks, who are they talking about? Listens a little more closely. They're talking about me. My talks are boring. They're not boring, they're always entertaining. But these people are just fools. They don't know a good talk when they hear one. They're fools. I'll get them the next time they come. But when very prominent people come and say, Venerable Sir, we were so impressed by you. And he becomes so swollen and he likes this. It's like music to his ears. He thinks, yes, lay devotees, please come again, please come again. Where if people give him very lavish gifts, sometimes he becomes very greedy to get more. First, maybe people will offer him just, can we offer you a little hut, Venerable Sir? Then before long, the hut isn't good enough. Well, I accept the hut, but, you know, I don't really have enough space there to move about. How about the two-story cottage? Then as he gets more famous and starts getting a large number of followers, then the cottage is not enough. He needs three or four-story mansion with many rooms to accommodate to all of his disciples. So in this way, one easily gets corrupted. And even if one doesn't get so grossly corrupt in such gross ways, but one comes to enjoy the sense of being the center of attention and getting a lot of invitations. If one doesn't get the invitations, instead of thinking, ah, now I can attend to my own study and practice, one just sits around waiting for the telephone to ring, for the mail to arrive, thinking, maybe when the telephone rings, ah, maybe that's an invitation coming. Or when the goes to the mailbox, maybe there's an invitation there. Okay, so these are some of the dangers which are come with fame and renown. And so when the monk is making this investigation of the Buddha, he knows that he has acquired renown and fame, but he hasn't been swept away by them. He has not submitted to these dangers that they present. He hasn't become proud, arrogant, supercilious, complacent, self-satisfied. He hasn't become greedy, building up a little empire for himself. But he sees that the Buddha is quite equanimous and detached under all conditions. Okay, then he makes a further inquiry. He asks whether this Venerable One, again this refers to the Buddha, is restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, and does he avoid indulging in sensual pleasures because he is without lust through the destruction of lust. And when he investigates him, he comes to know this Venerable One is restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, and he avoids indulging in sensual pleasure because he is without lust through the destruction of lust. Okay, this point is raised because if this is pursuing the inquiry to a very, very deep point where somebody might be quite sincere and dedicated in living the spiritual life, but his restraint and self-discipline are grounded partly in bhaya, the Pali word bhaya, which is translated fear. I give some examples. This would be fear, which is stems from the sense of conscience. One doesn't want to violate any of the basic ethical principles because one's conscience is keeping watch over one's behavior. This is the, say, sense of shame or fear of wrongdoing, fear of the consequences, fear of others' opinions. If one is caught misbehaving, then others will blame one and criticize one. Or the worst danger, if one really engages in very gross misconduct, then one might be constructing for oneself a bad rebirth in the next life. So fear as a means of discipline, this kind of fear stemming from the conscience, is a good quality in those who are still under training. But somebody who has completed the training and reached full enlightenment has to be utterly free from even the subtlest traces of defilements. And that means that one avoids indulging in sensual pleasures because he is without lust through the destruction of lust. That is, he has completely destroyed all lust, desire, craving, attachment, grasping. And now the question comes in paragraph 10. Somebody might come up to such a monk and say, what are your reasons? What is the evidence on the basis of which you say that this venerable one is restrained without fear and avoids indulging in sensual pleasures because he is without lust through the destruction of lust? How can he know this? Because this person, he's not able to read the mind of the Buddha himself. So really, he doesn't have direct perception of the mind of a Buddha and doesn't directly know that the Buddha has destroyed all lust. But he's able to judge on the basis of the Buddha's behavior. And so he explains what he has observed of the Buddha. First, he explains that whether that venerable one is dwelling in the Sangha or alone, while there are some there who are well-behaved and others who are well-behaved, some there who teach a group, I think we have to add, it seems like the phrase was lost, and some there who stay alone. While some here are seen very much concerned with material things, some in the Sangha are greedy for material gains, and others are quite detached from material, from the greed or craving for material things. Still, that venerable one does not despise or look down upon anyone because of that. In other words, when the Buddha is dwelling in the Sangha, then he is completely equanimous towards all the monks, those who are well behaved, those who are badly behaved, those who are engaged in activity, those who are living quietly, those who are attached to material things, those who are detached. The Buddha, of course, he will praise the good and virtuous, and he'll criticize and blame those who are violating the training, or those who are negligent. But in his own mind, he looks upon them with complete equality. He doesn't have any preferences for one and dislike for the others personally. There's a very powerful word in Pali which is used to describe this aspect of the Buddha's character. It's somewhat difficult to translate this into English, but it might be translated something like very badly as stability or perhaps equipoise. What it means is being the same despite changes in outer conditions, being the same whether there's gain or loss, the same whether one is praised or blamed. One is the same whether one is given honors or is left in obscurity. One is the same whether one is experiencing pleasant things or unpleasant things. So it's a state of complete inner balance, complete inner equipoise. And this is one said to be one of the characteristics of the Buddha. And then also when the monk is explaining on what basis he draws that conclusion, he also says that he has heard this from the Buddha himself. The Buddha himself has said that he is restrained without fear and that he doesn't indulge in sense pleasures because he is without lust through the destruction of lust. Okay, but now the Buddha goes on to say, to tell, or describing the inquisitive monk. He says that the monk, if he wants to, doesn't have to remain content only with what he can observe, but he should approach the Buddha himself and inquire from the Buddha if he wants to. This is really such an impressive statement. Often spiritual teachers, so they might make a big outer showing, but they'd like to be protected by a kind of defense line of disciples who won't allow others to approach them to make inquiries, direct inquiries from them about their behavior. Or else if the disciple comes and makes inquiries, they'll say, "Why are you questioning the teacher? You should know that I'm so far beyond the ordinary rules of morality that you can't judge my behavior on common standards." Or they might say, "Aren't you being presumptuous and arrogant, thinking you can come up to the teacher, to me, the teacher, and question me?" But the Buddha welcomes the disciples, says, "If you really want to make sure for yourselves, then come and ask me, and I'll tell you." It's said, and there's another sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, where it said that the Buddha has four things that he doesn't have to safeguard or protect. That is, his bodily behavior. He doesn't have to conceal it in any way, closing the doors to his cottage at certain times and telling his attendant, "Don't let anybody in after such and such a time." And then he doesn't have to safeguard or conceal his speech, telling certain things in secret to some people and then telling other things in secret to other people. But he speaks openly what has to be said. And then his states of mind, his thoughts don't have to be, of course, thoughts people don't generally observe, but he doesn't feel any need to be ashamed of them. And then the fourth is his way of living, the way he acquires his requisites of life, which are always obtained by receiving gifts and support from others. Okay, so the disciple comes to the Buddha and asks whether there are any defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear. And the Buddha will say, "No, there aren't." Actually, it would have seemed simpler if the text had said that the disciple can come to the Buddha and say, "Are there any defilements within you?" rather than to base it on visible or audible behavior. But this is the way the text is worded. "Are there any mixed states within you?" And the Buddha says, "No, no mixed states." "Are there found in you only pure or clean states?" And the Buddha says, "Clean states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. They are my pathway and my domain. Yet I do not identify with them. This is a very important phrase. By saying that I do not identify with them, the Pali expression here, tongue means simply that, and mai means consist of, and the is negation. So a tongue mai means I don't consist of that. In the sense, the implication is that he doesn't identify with these pure states, thinking that these are mine, or becoming proud on the basis of his purity. His states of body, speech, and mind are all pure, but there's no identification with them. He's completely detached from them. Okay, so now when the disciple has received these answers from the Buddha, now he's going to come to, and all of these inquiries in part two of the sutta, these are based upon personal testimony. Again, it's something that does not give certain knowledge, but at least it provides some basis for placing trust. But now the way to gain personal direct, to get full confirmation, is through direct experience. And so that brings us to the next section of the sutta. The Buddha says, a disciple should approach the teacher who speaks thus in order to hear the Dhamma. And then the teacher will teach him the Dhamma with its higher and higher levels, with its more and more sublime levels, with its dark and bright counterparts. And this reveals, in a way, some aspects of the Buddha's systematic approach to his teaching. When the Buddha presents the teaching, generally, at the introductory level, or even at more advanced levels, he'll start with very basic teachings, very general teachings. And then he will build up one stage upon another stage upon another till he brings the teaching to its climax or consummation with the highest attainments. So, for example, he'll usually begin with a talk on the benefits of generosity, of moral discipline, of leading a life of service and helpfulness to others. Then he will bring it to the higher training and the higher morality, then bring it to the development of sense restraint, then bring that further to the practice of mindfulness, clear comprehension, then to the development of samadhi or jhanas, then to the development of insight, wisdom, and then to the realization, the attainment of liberation. And then he also teaches very often by way of dark and bright counterparts. That is, when we look at many of the suttas, we see how the teaching unfolds. First, the Buddha will take what is called the dark side of the teaching, like what are unwholesome states of body, speech, and mind. What are their consequences, their karmic consequences? Then once he deals with the defiled states, then he'll take the bright side of the teaching. What are wholesome actions of body, speech, and mind? What are their consequences? Or what are the hindrances to meditation? What are the methods for getting rid of the hindrances? What are the delusions that spring from ignorance? And what are the correct principles that are discerned by wisdom? Okay, and then we come to the next sentence. As the teacher teaches the Dhamma to a bhikkhu in this way, through direct knowledge of a certain teaching, here in that teaching, the bhikkhu comes to a conclusion about the teaching. This is actually a pretty tricky sentence in Pali. Ah, here it is. I had written it out. I will write this in Pali. You just see the complexity of it. In a sentence, he, in that Dhamma, I understand, in that Dhamma which has been taught to him, abhinyaya, having directly realized here a certain Dhamma, a certain, you could say, certain principle of the teaching, he comes to a conclusion about the teaching as a whole. The commentary explains that having directly known the penetration or realization, it takes Dhamma here in this sense as being the Dhamma of realization, and this is the Dhamma as taught, and so the commentary on gloss is, having directly known a certain Dhamma of realization in the Dhamma that is taught, by reason of that Dhamma of realization, he comes to a conclusion about the Dhamma as the teaching. And according to the commentary, this passage describes the disciple's attainment of the stage of what is called sotapanna, or stream enterer. This is the first level of, you could call it the first level of enlightenment or awakening in early Buddhism, where after developing insight to the highest level, to the peak of the stages of insight, there comes a direct penetration of the truth of the Dhamma, so that one sees the same thing that the Buddha himself has seen and taught, just momentarily. But with that breakthrough of penetration, one comes to a complete inner confirmation of the truth of the teaching. And so then one can place confidence in the teacher, in the Buddha, thus, the Blessed One is fully enlightened. And one can place that confidence in the Buddha because one has seen the same truth that the Buddha has seen and has been teaching. And one knows that the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. One knows this because one has seen the truth of the Dhamma. And one knows that the Sangha, in this case it's not the monastic order, but the Sangha as the community of the Aryans, of the noble ones, the noble disciples, is practicing the good way, the good path. And then the Buddha goes on to say, if others should ask this bhikkhu, what are your reasons? What is the evidence whereby you make this claim about the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha? Answering rightly, that monk would answer as follows. Then he explains how he approached the Buddha, heard the Dhamma, and then by being taught the Dhamma, through direct knowledge of a certain teaching, he came to this conclusion about the teaching. And in this process, one thing seemed to have been left out, though it's implied, and I've added it in the outline. We have approaching the teacher, listening to the Dhamma, then the Buddha speaks about one attains direct realization or direct knowledge. But what is implied for most people, at any rate, is practice in accordance with the teaching. because in order to attain realization, in most cases one has to practice. There are some cases of individuals who, even while they're listening to the Buddha preach, because their faculties are very ripe, they attain direct realization right on the spot without having to undergo a period of practice. But most people listen to the teaching, learn it, then practice, then attain direct knowledge. Then the Buddha says, to conclude, he says, when anyone's faith has been planted, rooted, and established in the Tathagata through these reasons, terms, and phrases, his faith is said to be supported by reasons, rooted in vision and firm. I think the key word here is, or the key expression is, rooted in vision. It's in Pali, dasana mulaka. It's rooted in vision because this follower, this disciple, has seen the Dhamma for himself, seen the truth, the ultimate truth, the unconditioned truth. And so that faith, in a sense, it's been confirmed by actual experience. It's not yet full knowledge, full realization. That can only be achieved by continuing the practice to the final goal. But at this point, the disciple has caught a glimpse of the teaching, or the ultimate truth of the teaching, and just has to continue along that path to bring the vision to fulfillment. It's like a traveler who's traveling, say, across the country. He hears that there is a city on the other side of the mountain range, and he doesn't yet know for himself, but he's traveling, walking up the mountains, and there are several mountains following one after another, and after many days of toiling and treading up the mountains, sweating, worrying whether this journey is worthwhile or not, at a certain point he comes to the top of one mountain, looks down in the distance, and then sees the city in the distance. But now, to get there, he has to go down again, down the other side of the mountain, and walk up and down several more mountains. And when he goes down, then he's not able to see the city anymore. And again, maybe he has to enter into deep wilderness and continue walking, sometimes through heavy rains, hot sun, sometimes shortage of food and water. But now he knows the city is there, and he just has to continue on that path, and he will arrive at the city. And so now if somebody asks him, is the city there? He doesn't have to say, I depend on anybody else for my belief the city is there, but I've seen it for myself. And so in this case, the Buddha says that this disciple has faith which is invincible, or it's unshakable by any other ascetic or Brahmin, God or Mara or Brahma, or by anyone in the world. And that is how there is an investigation of the Tathagata in accordance with the Dhamma. And that is how the Tathagata has been well or properly investigated in accordance with the Dhamma. Just before I stop, I want to tell this a cute story that comes in the commentary to show how this faith of a noble disciple is unshakable by anyone in the world. It's a story about a lay follower during the time of the Buddha. His name was Sura. One time he was listening to the Buddha give a discourse, and the Buddha was speaking about the impermanence, selflessness of the five aggregates. Buddha said, form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perceptions are impermanent, and so on. And while this disciple was listening, he attained the first stage of awakening and became Sotapanna. Then he, after the discourse, he returned to his home, and Mara witnessed what was going on and thought, uh-oh, this lay disciple is going to escape. Mara is the devil of Buddhism, the tempter. So Mara thought, uh-oh, this disciple is going to escape from my grasp. He's going to get free. Let me try to shake up his mind. And so Mara, he has this ability to manifest any form he wants. So he manifested the form of the Buddha. And in the form of, he sent this form of the Buddha, or he sent himself in the form of the Buddha. He went to the house of the lay follower. He knocked on the door. The lay follower looked out the window and thought, ah, the master has come. And so the lay follower, he bowed down to this person, this figure, thinking this is the Buddha. politely offered him a seat. Said, what is it, venerable sir? Can I help you with anything? Then Mara, as Buddha said, just before, lay follower, you heard me give a sermon. And lay follower said, yes. In that sermon, I was talking about the impermanence of the five aggregates. The lay follower, Sura, said, yes, venerable sir. Then Buddha Mara said, well, when I was giving that sermon, I wasn't really thinking carefully enough. I was speaking a little too hastily, and after I finished speaking, I reconsidered, and I realized that I was only partly right, that many forms, feelings, perceptions, volitional formations, consciousness, are impermanent and not self, but there are a few types which are permanent and can be taken as self. Then the lay follower thought, no, come now. A Buddha doesn't change his mind about these basic truths of existence that I myself have realized. And then he thought, it's said that Mara can take even the form of a Buddha. And there's a principle that if Mara is questioned about something, he can never tell a lie. He always has to speak the truth. So the lay follower realized, this must be Mara in the form of the Buddha. So then he asked them, are you Mara? And so then he had to say, yes. And then the form of the Buddha disappeared and he revealed his own form. Then the disciple said, you can trick me. I have realized the truth for myself, and nobody in this world can make me change my mind. Then Mara realized he was defeated and disappeared. Okay, so that will be our yeah.
One quick question. So, in paragraph 8,
yeah,
it says, the one who's acquired renown, the same thing, those things are found in him.
Yeah.
It seems like it's an overgeneralization. Certainly, there could be unenlightened people who still, whatever reason, aren't affected by things.
That is so. That is definitely so, yeah. Yeah. Certainly so. But just the point here is that I see when he has acquired renown and attained fame, those dangers are found in him.
It seems like maybe I should have said those dangers could be found in
him. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But he's exposed, we could say that he's exposed to these. Yeah, it's an overgeneralization. Of course, yeah.
The Kalama Sutta, he's talking to the Kalamas who don't know. And
yeah.
But do we know the context of this Sutta, why he's explaining these Buddhas how to verify him? They seem to all be his followers.
Yeah, it seems that they've already placed enough trust in him in order to, especially he's speaking about a monk, so for somebody to become a monk, it requires, or at least generally presupposes, that they would have trust in the Buddha as a fully enlightened one. I guess this is, even though he takes the monk as an example, but perhaps it could be understood as having sort of wider implications, that somebody who has not yet placed trust in the Buddha, even to the extent of becoming a monk, can use these same principles as criteria for investigating the Buddha. Even maybe today we're not able to see the Buddha's behavior or to hear his words directly, but as a standard we could use the account of the Buddha's behavior that comes down in the text and the words of the Buddha. And if we read the text, we don't find anything that reveals the presence of greed, hatred, at least greed, hatred, anger. We don't see the Buddha getting angry at some people who reject him. Sometimes he's stern. He's not always pleasant with a smiling face. Sometimes when there are people, especially when monks misrepresent his teaching and distort the teaching, then he can become very, very severe. But he doesn't get angry at them. Even when Devadatta tried to kill him, tried to take control of the Sangha, he still maintains his equanimity, even though he's quite stern when he speaks to Devadatta. And again, no indications of greed in his behavior or his statements. And then from his teaching itself, one has to say that there's no indication that there's any kind of trace of delusion in those teachings. Any further questions? Maybe interesting question to explore is to what extent can these standards be applied today? Since today we don't have fully enlightened teachers, but we could still use these principles to some extent to judge whether somebody is qualified as a teacher, whether the behavior shows, at least the standard would have to be whether they are earnestly practicing to eliminate greed, hatred, and delusion, and whether they are at least conforming to standards of conduct which will help them to eliminate the defilements. Any thoughts about that? Okay, then maybe we stop for the day. And next week we take, I think it's Sutta 95. Yeah, Sutta 95. This is called the Chunky Sutta. The C in Pali is pronounced like CH, so it's like chunky peanut butter. Okay, if we dedicate the merit. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika.